Sorry for the hold up there. So we'll start off looking at this new decom vulnerability. As most of you have seen by now, exploit code has been published to the internet. Ben Jury and a couple of other people, maybe. Let's start at the beginning, though. LSD, an excellent security research group from Poland, discovered a buffer overflow in DECOM. They gave enough details in their advisory to work out fairly quickly that it was going to be a problem with the remote activation method within the iRemote activation interface. This is accessible in many ways. Typically, most exploits are exploiting it on 135. Now, with the remote activation interface, essentially, you can pass a wide character string, which is the path to a document to as an object to instantiate, essentially. Now, if it's a UNC-based path, like /, computer name, / share, / foo.doc, then there are two problems here. One is a stack-based buffer overflow with an overly long host name. That's what we'll be, demonstrating later on. The other is a heap-based overflow with an overly long document name. Now, I'm going to fire this off quickly. This is Windows XP over here. Sorry, over here and there. I'm going to fire this off. I've set a breakpoint at a crucial part of the code of rpcss.dll. So if I execute that. Okay, so we've hit our breakpoint. Now, before we overwrite, well, actually, after we overwrite the save return address, we overflow other stuff on the stack. As it happens, one of those things we overwrite is one of the parameters which was passed to the vulnerable function. Now, this is a type of char star star. Basically, now before the vulnerable procedure returns, we have a in here. I'll have to read it out because you guys won't be able to see it from there. We have move dword pointer eax comma edi. Essentially, what that's saying is move whatever's in edi and go to the eax register, the address pointed by the eax register, and store whatever's in edi there. So if we look at EDI, we can see it's, for those at the front anyway, who can see, this is basically the beginning of our buffer, /, computer name, and arbitrary exploit code going in. Now, what EAX points to, this is the char star star, actually it will probably be a W char star star, that's been passed. This is the parameter which has been passed to the vulnerable function. This parameter's popped into EAX, and then we're going to set a pointer to our, code, basically. This line of code is going to be crucial in exploiting this on Windows 2003 server, specifically because Windows 2003 has stack-based canaries, very much like Crispin Cowan's StackGuard. Supposedly, and I'm quite willing to believe it, an independent invention on Microsoft's part, but essentially does the same thing. We'll get to that stuff later on. In terms of exploiting it on other platforms, however, Windows NT4 is vulnerable, Windows 2000 is vulnerable, Windows XP is vulnerable. Pretty much everyone's vulnerable. So patch this, by the way, because I don't know if many of you read Tim Mullen's new article on securityfocus.com. Nice read, as always. Tim has got dibs on the name of the one that's going to exploit this, called Mescaline, and I have no doubt there will be a one that exploits this in the near future. So if you haven't patched this yet, patch it. If you can't apply the patch, at least disable decom on the systems. You do that by running decom cnfg, by the way. So anyway, here we are. We've launched our exploit against this XP box here. Now, going back to the move dword pointer EAX EDI, We control EAX because we've overflowed the stack, basically. We've overwritten the save return address. Now we're continuing on writing, you know, stuff that was passed on, you know, stuff on the stack. Because we can do that, we overwrite this stuff. When, if I scroll up here a bit, right, the line above is move into EAX, dword pointer, EBP plus 0CH. H standing for hex, obviously. So what we're doing here is taking... this isn't that secret, you know. Okay, so we're taking stuff that was passed to the procedure, move it into EAX. Now, because we've overflowed that, we control what goes into EAX, essentially. So we can set or overwrite the parameter that will eventually become EAX. We can overwrite that with any 32-bit value we see fit. So we could overwrite it with a function pointer that points to our shellcode that when that function pointer is called, it will go and get executed. We'll look at this as another thing in a minute. At the moment with Windows XP and Windows 2000, I'm just using somewhere within an unused portion of the PB. It's always going to be writable and it can always be found at the same location. So, you know, we opt for that on an XP and 2000 exploit. So if I, unfortunately you're not going to be able to see this happening, but essentially this code gets uses the TB to get a reference to the PEB, and then from there we get the you know, the loaded module list and everything. We then get the base address of kernel32.dll. Using that, we can then find the address of getproc address. We then, you know, by parsing the PE header and so on, we then basically get the address of load library A, and armed with those two bits of information, we can load arbitrary libraries and get arbitrary addresses. This just basically spawns a reverse shell. Now, it's unfortunate that we can't split the things at the moment, but the good thing about, well, the good thing, maybe the bad thing about this particular problem is calling exit thread, fine. You know, we exit the thread and we can continue to exploit this time and time again. So if we lose our shell, we just fire off the exploit again and we get our shell back again. So in terms of continuation of execution, it's great. We don't kill RPCSS. If we did, you know, if RPCSS did die, and we couldn't recover the process, then with things like Windows XP and Windows 2003, you've got 60 seconds to do your nefarious deeds because the system will be shut down automatically. Okay, so if I F5 this, that's just gone. We've exited a couple of threads and stuff like that, and I've got my... Ooh, I would have had my shell had I had Netcat listening, so let me do that again. Execute. We hit our breakpoint again. F5. Alright, we're done. And I've got a shell, which you unfortunately can't see. For those with extreme eagle eyes, there you go. Yeah, I suppose I could do that. So, every time I speak at Black Hat, something goes terribly wrong. Last night, I thought it was the event had happened kind of thing. I'd lost my passport, and being the numpty I am, I'd actually left it on my bed. So for all those who actually helped me look for my passport yesterday, apologies for wasting your time. It might be a passport one time, it might be a brother another time I lose, you know? For all those that remember when my brother went missing in Las Vegas. Okay, so here's our shell, and we're Gladius on this box, we're recovery. Now, this is running, RPCSS is running with system privileges, so we completely own this box. In terms of exploitation, with Windows 2000 and Windows XP, we can actually, before we launch the exploit, look at what interfaces are available on the endpoint mapper. So if I actually swizz back to the code, before we do anything, essentially, I do a check OS down here. Essentially, all we're doing is, you know, creating a binding to RPC and then dumping all the interfaces. Now, if let me do this so you can actually see the bits of text. Okay, can everybody see that? Or should I make the font bigger? It's good, yeah? Okay, Windows XP and Windows XP alone has this interface, 1D55B526, blah, 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 blah. So we can accurately determine by, you know, connecting to 135 and saying, give me a list of registered interfaces on this endpoint, we can determine whether it's running XP. Windows 2000 and Windows 2000 alone has an interface of 975201BO. I like that BO in there. You know, this interface is exclusive to Windows 2000. So we can begin to, without even having to guess, you know, what operating system we're dealing with. Actually, Ofer Arkin's got some good stuff with using ICMP fingerprinting. He can work it out to the service pack level and sometimes even the hotfix level, which is quite good stuff he's got going there. Does anyone know if Ofer is speaking this?
He is.
Okay, you should see Ofer's speech. It should be quite good. I'm not sure if he's speaking on his ICMP stuff this time around. But anyway, nice plug there. So a worm could do this as well. So again, another reason why this is a dangerous thing, get it patched as soon as possible or disable DCOM. Okay. We then, you know, once we've ascertained what system we're dealing with, Windows XP, oh, by the way, when we overwrite the save return address, there are two ways we can go about exploiting it. One is just slap all of our shellcode after the save return address, do a jump ESP, overwrite the save return address with a jump ESP, that is. So when the ret is called, actually it's a ret 8 in this case, so in other words, we return, you know, take the top thing off the stack, but then the stack is added by 8, essentially. So when ret 8 is called, the address on the top of the stack, which is what we control, is a jump ESP, you know, it points to a jump ESP instruction. So when that executes, we then go back to ESP and start executing downwards from there. By putting all of your shellcode after the ESP can sometimes be problematic. You know, the exploit will work maybe four times out of five, and, you know, that fifth time it will crash not inexplicably, it can be explained, but there's no need to go into it. Because there is a solution to this problem. All we need is a tiny, tiny bit of shellcode after ESP. If we come across here again, remember we were moving EDI into DWORD pointer EAX. Well, ESI also points to the shellcode. So after, you know, the vulnerable procedure returns, ESI points to our shellcode. So what we could say is, you know, just put a tiny bit of, stop that there. We would not overwrite the save return address with a jump ESI. The reason being our shellcode or our buffer must start in Unicode /0/0. You know, it must be that. That in assembly code, when you translate that, is pop ESP add byte pointer EAX plus EAX plus N comma BL, okay? So if EAX plus EAX plus N, N being the next byte in the buffer, if that is not writable, the process will crash and we've lost it, okay? So this is going to be one of the annoying things about Windows 2003, we'll see in a minute, but this is why we would not do a jump ESI, because ESI points to that /0/0. EAX has never been writable in my testing, so it's the wrong way to go in terms of, you know, having a 100% effective exploit. So what I will do, however, is push 44 onto the stack. This is after ESP. I've done a jump ESP. So I push 44 onto the stack, pop it into EAX, then add EAX to the ESI. So ESI now doesn't point to my //. It points somewhere down below that. We then do the jump ESI. So we only need a tiny bit, this stuff here, highlighted, 7 bytes of shellcode after ESP that will then jump us back to where our main shellcode can be found. And then we avoid that problem of, you know, the crash every, you know, 1 time out of 5, and it works 100% reliably. Okay. Exploiting this on Windows 2000, Windows XP, Windows NT4, it's dead easy. Windows 2003 is another kettle of fish. So what I'm going to do now is basically start debugging on, this is a Win2K3 server. Where are we? RPCSS 808. Right, I'm going to switch cables now. Oh. This side here. No. Actually, wait a minute. This side. BIOS are excellent laptops. They're just sometimes trying to find things on there, you know. Okay, let's. Okay, if we can't get this coming through, I'll just have to explain it. Okay, stack-based canaries. Essentially what we do with those, it's a protection mechanism to stop, you know, classic stack-based buffer overflows. So we take the Sabre chain address, XOR it with what one would hope is a randomly generated value, and that becomes our canary. Now, if we overflow a buffer on the stack all the way down to the Sabre chain address, we actually overwrite a copy of this canary. Now, when the... Do I have RPCSS? Sorry, just bear with me 2 seconds. Okay, I'm just currently looking for, this is the output of IDA, another excellent tool. And I'm just currently looking for the place that does the canary checking. Okay, I'd rather than waste time on that. Okay, so what happens is the canary is compared with an authoritative version that's stored in the .data section of rpcss.dll. So in terms of exploiting this on Windows 2003 server, we could actually attack the canary itself. Because of that, remember that move into dword pointer EAX, EDI? If we can predict where our buffer can be found in memory, we could attack the canary. We could overwrite the authoritative version of the canary in the .data section of rpcss.dll with an address that points to our buffer. When we overwrite the canary, we also set that to the same. So when the compare happens, they match, and we overwrite the subroutine address, and bing, we're in business. Problem is, we can't predict effectively the location of where our shellcode is going to be found. So we can't use that as an attack. Now, if the compare fails, which it will in this case because we can't attack the authoritative canary, we check to... Do we know what that noise is, by the way? Sorry? It's my cables. It's like, okay, I'll stand still. If that's possible for me, then. Okay. What the security code then does, you know, if the canaries don't match, we check to see if a function pointer has been set, again within the .data section of rpcss.dll, and if it's zero, don't call it. If it's not zero, then call it. So again, we have another opportunity here. We could overwrite this function pointer within the rpcss.dll.data section with a pointer to our shellcode. Problem is, it must start with /0/0, which turns into cruddy assembly code. So we crash. No joy. Okay, so once that, you know, does there exist a security handler, if that, you know, is not called kind of thing, what the code then does is call set unhandled exception filter. Now, on Windows, the unhandled exception filter basically is a last ditch, you know, everything in terms of exception handling has gone wrong. That's the thing that will eventually be called. Someone hacking me. Okay. That's the thing that's going to be called. However, the security code clears it. It does set unhandled exception filter 0. In other words, if we had attacked the unhandled exception filter by, you know, overwriting that with a pointer to our shellcode, which would have been useless anyway because of the /0, you know, /0 and stuff, Microsoft clear it. You know, they do set unhandled exception filter (0)(semicolon). So that's gone, okay? They then call the unhandled exception filter function. So if we're going to find a way of exploiting this on Windows 2003 server, we can look at the code of unhandled exception filter to do this. Now, it does a number of things. This actually, I have, here's one I made earlier. Okay, this here is the disassembly of unhandled exception filter. Now, if we scroll down, we can see loads of things are being called, such as get profile string W. Get profile string W passes down to get private profile string W. We get profile string A. What else is called? We load a library called faultrep.dll. That's here. I'm sorry, we can't increase the font here. Faultrep.dll is going to be loaded. We then do a get system directory W. Now, here's a possible attack method. Get system directory W references a pointer within the .data section of kernel32.dll that says if you want the Windows system directory, look at this address. So if we overwrite this pointer, again with that, you know, where we get that opportunity to do the move dword pointer EAX, EDI, if we overwrite that, then we can say the Windows system directory is /// stuff, okay? That's a UNC path. If we can trick the server, you know, the Winter K3 server into trying to resolve that name, you know, as a UNC path, it will load our faultrep.dll. As long as we export the function report fault, then we're in business because it will connect to us. We put it in a null session share. It connects, downloads faultrep.dll, loads it, executes report fault, and that's where we stuff our nasty code. So that's a possibility. The only problem is, remember, we're overflowing the stack with it's the host name. That's what we're overflowing. So what we need to do is try and put stuff in there which is fairly benign and make it look like a domain name. Now, I mean, when it like polls for that, you know, IP address, it's not an existent domain name. So we have to reply to it. You know, we have to just send a number of replies saying if you ever look for this address. It depends on whether it's actually using like a DNS lookup. Then we have to sniff its ID and respond with that and everything like that. But it is a feasible attack. But it's not a nice attack. I don't like it. It's too crummy. So what else do we do? We call loader unlock loader lock. These LDR functions, loads of them, look to see if a function pointer has been set within the data section of ntdll.dll, and if you know the function pointer is not zero, it actually calls it. Now I can't see anywhere in the code of ntdll.dll that actually sets these pointers. So I wonder whether it's a leftover from, you know, whilst Microsoft were developing Windows 2003, it was like put debug code in here kind of thing. So anyway, it references a pointer, which we, again, could overwrite. That's then moved into EAX, and EAX is called if it's not zero. Again, we're left with the same problem, however, of /0/0. So the thing is, when LSD put out their advisory, they said they've got a way of exploiting this on Windows 2003, bypassing the Canary protection stuff. So there's two options. One, they're either using the heap-based overflow to exploit it on Windows 2003, which I don't think. I actually believe that the LSD have found a way to defeat the stack protection stuff. So the only theory I've come up with, and I unfortunately haven't had time to prove it yet, I actually need to speak to Greg. Is Greg around, by the way? Greg Hoglund? He's not in at the moment. Okay. Yeah, Greg and I are going to work on this later on, basically. What I'm looking to do is cause a nested overflow, a secondary overflow, within the code of unhandled exception filter. Now, for a moment, imagine when we call get system directory up here. Imagine no length checking was done here. This is to explain the theory. Imagine no length checking was done. They assume, well, a Windows path name is 256 bytes long, so we'll declare a buffer of 256 bytes on the stack and reference this pointer. It's going to be trusted. It's only going to be /Windows/System32 anyway. So let's, whatever the pointer points to, just copy it to that buffer. Now imagine that went on, and we overwrite the pointer to the Windows System 32 directory with a pointer to our big long buffer. Well, there would be an overflow there, and what's more, it's an unprotected code. There is no canary checking done in this stuff. So if we can find somewhere within unhandled exception filter, and there's loads of places it could be, we could cause a secondary overflow on the stack and nest our real exploit within the bigger exploit. Now, as I said, I haven't found it yet, but it could be anywhere. It could be actually in reportfault.dll. Faultrep.dll in the report fault function. Report fault function. That does tons of stuff. Essentially what that function does is, you know when you get that annoying message like, Do you want to send this bug to Microsoft? No, don't send kind of thing. That's the fault reporting stuff. That's what this DLL does, and it does a hell of a lot of things. So there's plenty of opportunity there for us to find a reference to a pointer and possibly cause the secondary overflow. If LSD have found a way, that might be the way they're doing it. I don't know. It will be interesting to see, you know, when they publish their mechanism, what it turns out to be. Or in the interim, hopefully I can find this secondary overflow kind of technique. Anyway, are there any questions on that stuff at all? Sure, at the back there. Okay, essentially the question is, most of the exploits are currently using TCP. Is this possible over UDP? That's essentially the question. Okay. The reason he asked the question, as you pointed out, was that SLAMR was UDP based. And basically with UDP, we can just say, you know, bing, 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 fire out billions of packets. I don't really care whether it gets there or not because it's connectionless. I don't have to go through this whole handshake and stuff. I haven't actually tried it on UDP, to be honest, but I hear other people have successfully managed to do it with UDP, which, if they're correct, which I believe they are, then it's going to be as bad as SLAMR. If a worm is going to be written for it, several variations will be written, I would imagine. One that will hit XP, one that will hit Windows 2000, and, you know, other operating systems, because of the jump ESP required. Basically, it's, I mean, if you could find, actually EI, I think, posted something saying they've found some way to make it portable across all platforms, you know, so if they've found that, then, you know, that would be extremely bad indeed. But assuming that there is no way to do it on all platforms, then you would probably find various versions going out there, some which will target Windows XP, some Windows 2000, and so on. Now, if it hits XP, if a Windows 2000 one hits an XP box, well, hey, you know, it shuts down and restarts within 60 seconds kind of thing. So eventually, you know, the law of diminishing returns says eventually it will get hit by a Windows XP one. With Windows 2000, well, it's not quite so clean that way. You know, RPCSS will die and the box will stay up. It won't be shut down. But, you know, someone will boot it up again and stuff like that because something didn't work and eventually it will get hit. The problem will, of course, be exacerbated if, indeed, it is vulnerable over UDP. Has anyone actually confirmed whether it is in here or not? Anybody? Anybody? Bueller? Bueller? No? Okay. Oh, was that yes over there? No? Okay. Sorry, it wasn't. Okay. Question?
It
depends on what the payload does, really. Your arbitrary exploit code, you know, to do nasty things, you could, you know, make it 200 bytes. The shellcode I'm using there is about 400 bytes. And that, all that does is spawn a reverse shell. You know, if you're trying to get a worm going, you know, then it will be a completely different payload, essentially. Okay. Any other questions on that? Sure, gentlemen here. Yep.
Is that required, or is it a possible one-to-one packet exploit? No,
I would believe that would be required. As I said, I've not tested it over UDP. If it doesn't, then, well, that's going to be even worse then, kind of thing. But I would imagine it's like a wee bit of a conversation first. But the thing is, you can still fire those packets out with actually, you might actually need a binding handle or something like that. Yeah, I'm going to have to look into this UDP stuff a bit more. Okay, sir?
I've seen reference that it's possible to report
the... Yeah. My brother has. If you enable COM internet-based services, it can be done. In fact, Todd Sabin had a discussion with Ross Cooper about this on BugTrack. saying, Todd Sabin was saying, I think Todd Sabin's with Bindview, Razor, is he still there? Anyone know? Okay, it doesn't matter. Essentially, he was saying, I'm looking at a debugger right now that I've, you know, got a breakpoint set, I've got the exploit going, and it's been done over port 80. I haven't done it, my brother has, and I believe Todd Sabin has, so I'm going to trust these guys, you know. Not many people have, you know, comm internet services enabled anyway, but it's, if you are using it in your environment, then you're going to have to think of ways to mitigate the risk if you're not applying the patches. Okay, any other questions on this stuff? Sure. Right. In terms of bypassing the canary stuff?
Yeah.
By overwriting the authoritative version?
Yeah.
Right. Essentially, let's say our shellcode can be found, our buffer, not our shellcode, rather. Our buffer can be found at address 00FFFFFF. Okay. If we, using the move dword pointer EAX, EDI, EDI will have 00FFFFFF in it. Okay. That will, if we use that then to overwrite the, you got it, okay, sure, sorry. Yeah, well, I'll explain it perhaps in more detail. Yeah, the authoritative version of the cookie is stored in the .data section of rpcss.dll. With the move dword pointer EAX, EDI, if we set EAX to the address of where we can find, you know, the authoritative version, that EDI, being 00FFFFFF, you know, the pointer to our buffer, basically, is then written to that address. So we overwrite the authoritative version of the canary. If we then overwrite, you know, the portion of the stack that turns out to be the canary with 00FFFFFF, when it's moved into ECX and the comparison's done with the, you know, dword pointer authoritative version, the compare will succeed. So then we just do a normal stack-based overflow kind of thing. The only problem is the pointer to our buffer is not in the same place every time. So it's not an effective way of exploiting it. Okay. Any other questions? No? I've been looking at exception handling over the past couple of days. With Windows, and imagine someone sets up an exception handler which is completely and utterly draconian. It says, nope, someone's attacking me, exit process. That's not safe. One would think it would be, but it's not. On Windows NT4, Windows 2000, and Windows XP, exit process does a number of interesting things. Now, within the PEB, there are two pointers. Well, there's actually several pointers, but two of interest. One points to RTL enter critical section. The other points to RTL leave critical section. Now, in the process of exiting a process, a low-level NTDLL function is called RTL acquire PEB lock. That uses that pointer within the PEB to call enter critical section. That is at a consistent address across Windows NT4, Windows XP, and Windows 2000. If we overwrite that, then, you know, with a pointer to our shellcode, this is going on to heap overflows or format string vulnerabilities and stuff like that, rather than this, because of this // stuff. When the process is shutting down, basically, we can reverse that by, you know, when RTL acquire PEB lock, when that's called, it references that point at which we pointed to our shellcode, and we can basically stop, you know, the process from shutting down, execute our nasty arbitrary code and everything like that, and we're in business. Now, the benefit of this is, I mean, it's widely been discussed, you know, attacking the unhandled exception filter, but that moves, unfortunately. So with heap overflows, I think one of the best approaches to go with now is attacking this PEB, especially if you can cause an access violation and have the unhandled exception filter kick in, because that's going to do the same kind of things. With Windows 2003, it's slightly different. Those pointers within the PB have gone. I mean, the addresses are still there. Sorry, the addresses aren't there. It's null, but the same location is. It's just null now. But we still have this, you know, LDR stuff going on, these LDR functions that are looking for this hidden EAX thing. It's just a new thing that people can start looking at, you know, if they're exploiting things like heap overflows and format string vulnerabilities and stuff like that. I just wanted to wrap up with that. We're sort of running out of time. So I'll tell you what, are there any final questions? No? Oh, sorry, sure. Well, the question is, if someone does write a worm using UDP, is there going to be any restrictions on them spoofing the source IP address? Two points on that. One is, if we need a binding handle, you know, if we make the first connection and say, give us some information back so we can make a further request, then spoofing the IP address, well, if it's not on our network segment, we don't get to see that response and we lose that information we need. So that would be a preventative problem with that. And of course, if they didn't need to do that, most modern firewalls will look at the, if they're trying to do an attack by spoofing the IP address of an inside host, then most firewalls will say, well, that's come from the outside, you know, and that's you know, pretending to be from the inside, drop the packet kind of thing. But you could, if you're not trying to do that kind of attack, if you're trying to make it look like the attacker's, you know, over in the Bahamas, when in actual fact the attacker's like in Alaska, you know, then sure, possibly you could do that. But again, I don't know enough about the UDP vector because you might need a binding handle kind of thing there. Sure, another question here?
With Microsoft having released 9 vulnerabilities in the last month, why would this be so different
as opposed to all the other ones in the last month? Right. Could you rephrase the question because I'm not sure what you're driving at? Okay. Right. This one, essentially the question is, what's so amazing about the DCOM stuff when there's plenty of other Microsoft, recent Microsoft vulnerabilities out there? Well, it's a cool bug for a start, you know, I'm excited by it. It's unauthenticated, no credentials are required. It's a remote root, essentially. Those are few and far between on Windows. You know, you might have an Internet Explorer buffer overflow which requires you to send someone an HTML page and say, Britney Spears can be found here in the nude or whatever kind of thing, you know. You know, you have to entice people kind of thing. Those kind of attacks are really lame and boring and cross-site scripting, you know, as well, whoop-de-doo kind of thing. I don't know. The other problem with this is they're all vulnerable. All Windows, modern Windows platforms at least anyway, used in a business context, mind you, I bet there's a lot of businesses out there that use 98 and 95 still. These are supposed to be like a secure operating system, and they're all vulnerable, and that's why it's so exciting as well, you know? So, any other questions? No? Okay, well, I hope everyone enjoys the rest of the conference, and